This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalbathanchel. Last month, WNPR hosted a screening of the PBS documentary Understanding the Opioid Epidemic. Afterwards, we taped a panel discussion with three guests to respond to the film and to share their perspectives on the issue of treating substance abuse in our local communities. Our panelists included Sue Kruzek, a Guilford, Connecticut resident who lost her son Nick to an opioid overdose, Kelvin Young, a Middletown resident who's in recovery and now assists others as a certified recovery advisor at Aware Recovery Care, Inc., and Dr. Robert Heimer, professor of epidemiology and pharmacology at Yale School of Public Health, also a member of the Connecticut Opioid Response Team. The PBS film Understanding the Opioid Epidemic focused partly on the fault of the medical community for the opioid crisis, from physicians overprescribing opioid drugs to pharmaceutical companies marketing and distributing incorrect information about the addictiveness of opioids to consumers. I asked Dr. Heimer to talk about the role of doctors and pharmaceutical companies and whether attitudes in the industries have changed.
It certainly is changing, but I think we need to think in a more historical perspective, starting going back to, as the film points out, that in the 80s and 90s, there was this recognition of pain as a medical problem that got in the way of people healing from a variety of acute or chronic problems, and that pain was also a problem that was not being properly dealt with in terminal illness. And it turned out that we had one kind of hammer to deal with all kinds of pain, and those were opioids. Without the data to support the benefits of opioids for treating chronic pain. We now have 30 years of medical knowledge that says opioids do not do well for treating chronic pain. But there's even a more fundamental reason why opioids were used for treating chronic pain, and that is that other alternatives were just simply not affordable or available. You know, you have chronic back pain or some other kind of neuromuscular pain, the best advice is, you know, rest for weeks. Well, doctor, I can't rest. I have to go to work. I have 2 weeks of medical leave. I can't take 3 months off. I can't take it. I won't even have my job when I go back. Okay, what about physical therapy? Well, every time you go, there's a copay. I can't afford the copay. I can't take the time. I need something so I can go back to work tomorrow. Well, what do I have to send you back to work tomorrow is opioids. I can write your prescription now for 30 days, come back and see me in 30 days. That's why opioids started being prescribed for chronic pain. And they continue to be to this day somewhat problematically, although the number of prescriptions has decreased every year now since 2010, but the number of opioid overdose deaths have not. And the reason is what's replaced opioids, pharmaceutical opioids, known fixed safe doses is street drugs of unsafe doses. And so this supply side approach to controlling the opioid epidemic has actually worsened the problem.
You're talking about heroin?
Heroin and other drugs that are actually replacing heroin in many places, the synthetic opioid fentanyl.
Sue has a very personal story related to the opioid epidemic in this country. So maybe you want to tell our audience a little bit about your connection and then your reaction to what you're hearing tonight.
So I lost my son, Nick, 4 years ago to a heroin overdose. His addiction started his freshman year on his ice hockey team. He was the starting center at Daniel Hand High School, and in the locker room, an upperclassman handed him a pill to help him relax. Mm. And apparently Nick must have enjoyed the feeling it gave him. Unbeknownst to us, he never skated a high school game sober. And ultimately, when he was in college, came to us telling us that he needed to go to rehab. We had to find out for what. We had no idea. I had to Google at the time what an opiate was. And we had to put him on a plane. We had Anthem Blue Cross insurance. Back then, I hope this has changed, our insurance didn't cover detox in the state of Connecticut. So we had to put Nick blindly on a plane to a rehab facility or detox first in Florida. And he went down there and he did have a misdemeanor hanging over his head. So for about 9 months, we'd have to fly Nick home every month to go to court to get postponed. And then eventually they just put him on probation, which, because it was not a felony, it was only a misdemeanor, he could not leave the state of Connecticut or go back to his rehab facility. And 2 months later, after Nick got an apartment and got a job and re-enrolled at Southern, we found him in his apartment dead. He had overdosed.
I'm sorry that you lost your son. This was in 2013?
Yes, yes. 11 days before he should have been 21.
Now it's 2018, and you've been traveling the state with other parents who have dealt with either trying to get their children help or burying them because of their addiction to substances. I mean, where are you in your process of grief? And in that process, when we talk about, again, how we ended up at this point, who are you angry at? Are you angry?
The world. I'm very angry, yes. I'm angry at us because we thought he would just kind of go away to rehab and he'd be fixed. We were so uneducated as parents, as a family, my entire family. We truly believed he was going to be okay. I'm angry at Purdue Pharma for flooding our streets with this pill that started my son's addiction and ended up taking his life. And the doctors for writing senseless scripts for every broken bone, wisdom teeth that helped to flood our streets. And, you know, where a 15-year-old boy could think he was innocently taking something. And I know that decision was Nick's too. And there was a time I was angry at Nick. I didn't understand the beast of this addiction. I'd like to say I'm not angry at Nick anymore, just everybody else.
You helped lawmakers draft legislation and did turn into law that would put a cap on prescription of opioids for non-chronic pain for 7 days. So you see some strides to try to curb this problem in our community. Is it effective?
The 7-day cap? I'm hopeful that it will prevent some first-time users from becoming addicted. I'm very hopeful for that. I'm hopeful that it's helping alleviate all the excess prescriptions and pills that have been flooding our state and our country from even being out there. Yes, I'm proud of those two components to it.
Kelvin Young is sitting next to you. You also have a personal connection to this discussion tonight. Tell us about your recovery and what your thoughts are in how communities, not only here in Connecticut, but nationwide, are starting to try to address this problem.
Absolutely. You know, as of being a certified recovery coach or certified recovery advisor and sound practitioner, I'm a person that's in recovery from alcohol and other drugs, including cocaine, heroin, and other opiates. You know, and for me, after many years of battling with different types of emotional distresses like depression, anxiety, I reached out for something outside of myself to feel better. And I reached out to the cocaine, I reached out to the heroin, I reached out to the alcohol and to the marijuana, the OxyContin to make me feel better. And those experiences led me to incarceration. And while incarcerated, I learned about the transformative powers of yoga, meditation, and creative expressive arts like poetry and journaling, different holistic practices that I believe that needs to be billable and insured for people to utilize going through these addictive experiences. And by utilizing these different practices while incarcerated, I was able to find a sense of calmness and inner peace being in a very hostile and restrictive environment such as prison. But most importantly, I was able to get to the root causes of my addiction. And from my experience, I learned that the unresolved emotional distress and pain, the unhealed trauma, the unmet needs was at the root of my addiction. So therefore, I was reaching for something outside of myself to find relief from those different types of emotional pain. And I used a physical painkiller, like OxyContin, like heroin, to deal with emotional pain. And it worked. Boy, did it work. It worked for a while until it didn't work. And I got caught up in that very vicious cycle of addiction. But by going within, and to me, that's where healing truly begins. We have an opportunity to go inside of ourselves. And I was able to see those different types of emotional stresses that I was experiencing in my life for many, many years. And I like to use the analogy is, you know, we have a weed growing in our yard. And, you know, we could get the lawnmower out and we could cut the weed, and, you know, we don't see the weed in the lawn for a while, you know, a day or maybe 7 days. But eventually that weed will grow back. So if I go in my yard and pull out the roots of that weed, chances are really great that that weed is not going to grow back. So therefore, for me, I had to get to the root causes of my emotional distress, the root cause of my addiction. And I learned that experience. And, you know, recovery is a lifelong journey. It's a process towards living better and being healthier. But the key for me was taking personal responsibility for my health and well-being. But one of the things that the film did touch upon was the part that Big Pharma played in this epidemic that we're experiencing right now. And I've been saying this for a little while now, but it's time for us to hold Big Pharma accountable for the part that they played in this epidemic. Well, you know, for far too long, they falsified information, put out very aggressive propaganda, you know, with the marketing campaigns, and pretty much straight up lied to us and saying how non-addictive that these drugs were. And they made billions of dollars every year. And with that, those billions of dollars, they have the influence, so to speak, to really hire lobbyists to influence different policies on a government level. They have finances to influence politicians. They have, you know, to influence doctors, to influence the medical communities. And even right now, influence the recovery community. They have a lot of money to really influence a lot of decision-making. So therefore, it's important that we hold them accountable for the part that they played in. It's time to pay out.
Here in Connecticut, I know the city of New Haven is one of more than a dozen municipalities that are suing these pharmaceutical companies, including Purdue Pharma, which, if you don't know, is based in Stamford, Connecticut. So there are more actions to try to hold people accountable. But at the same time, no money in the world brings back the lives Absolutely. Of people that have died. Nick, Sue's son. I think we're on track. I think we're waiting for the latest numbers from the Connecticut Medical Examiner for 2017, on track to surpass more than 1,000 overdose deaths here in Connecticut. But you also brought up a good point. I wanted to get Robert Heimer's perspective. Kelvin brought up a good point about how, for him, he figured it out to try to find the root cause of why he was looking for substances to help him cope. When we talk about this problem, we focus on who's prescribing and who's producing these pills. But what about the state of our mental health support network and the fact that if people are suffering, that they can get help before they go to that substance to help them cope?
Well, I think Kelvin was absolutely correct when he said that many people start the road to addiction because they're self-medicating for some other mental health problem that's not being addressed. And of course, we have great stigma around mental health still and around addiction, which is another mental health problem, all of which make seeking treatment on the part of individuals very difficult. We don't go to the doctor because we have high blood pressure or diabetes and feel like it's our personal failure. We don't go to the doctors because we have cancer and feel like it's our failing. And until we broaden our conceptions about mental health and recognize that these are treatable conditions, these are manageable conditions, then we can begin to deal with individual problems before they become self-medicated with drugs like opioids.
That's Dr. Robert Heimer, professor of epidemiology and pharmacology at Yale School of Public Health and member of the Connecticut Opioid Response Team. He's one of three panelists we spoke to at a discussion recently at Gateway Community College in New Haven. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Coming up, we'll hear from him and our guests, Sue Kruzek of Guilford and Kelvin Young of Middletown. We'll ask each of them what they believe are the best strategies for treating people addicted to opioids. That's after the break. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. We're continuing to have conversations about how the opioid epidemic has affected communities across our state. We've addressed the crisis from a number of angles. Is there a perspective we're missing? We'd like to hear from you. Email wherewelive@wmpr.org and find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Today, we're listening to a recent panel discussion we hosted at Gateway Community College in New Haven. Three panelists joined us to provide their perspectives on how to combat substance abuse in local communities. Our guests were Kelvin Young, a Middletown, Connecticut man in recovery, who now works with others who have substance abuse issues, Sue Kruzek, a Guilford, Connecticut mother who lost her son Nick to an opioid overdose, and Dr. Robert Heimer, professor of epidemiology and pharmacology at Yale School of Public Health. I asked Dr. Heimer about his role with the state opioid response team.
Well, 2 years ago, the governor asked four of us at Yale to come up with a plan. A pain management physician, the emergency department, general medical practitioners who use medication-assisted treatment, mostly buprenorphine, for dealing with opioid use disorder, and me. I'm an epidemiologist who's been studying the drug epidemic in Connecticut since 1990. And we came up with a six-point plan that basically says this is what we need to do. This is evidence-based. We know we need to do these things. We need to expand medication-based treatment. We need to develop better communication among the state agencies. We need to get more naloxone, Narcan out in the streets to prevent overdose deaths from happening by treating people who are experiencing overdose before that overdose becomes a death. And we need to have ways to better control opioid prescribing to keep it from being overused for conditions where it's inappropriate, like treating chronic neuromuscular pain or autoimmune disease pain, where these drugs simply don't work. If you're in a car accident, if you have surgery, these drugs help you recover. They don't work for treating chronic pain. And if any of you are prescribed an opioid for chronic pain, by all means say no, give me something else. Yeah. I also have to say we have to change the whole perception of what's appropriate treatment for opioid use disorder. The proper treatment, we have 100 years of experience with abstinence-based treatment, it doesn't work. It simply doesn't work. You don't recover from addiction. You recover from the flu, you recover from a broken arm. You have to encourage people to seek continued treatment for opioid use disorder. There's just no way around it. We have a 50 now, almost 60 year history of treating opioid addiction with medications. Yes, they're opioids, but they work very differently from short-acting opioids like heroin or oxycodone. And they maintain people in a state of normal life. I've never become an opioid addict, but I've talked to a lot of them, and almost all of them say, I don't take my opioids to get high anymore. I take them to feel normal. Mm. And the point of these maintenance drugs is they allow people to feel normal. Instead of waking up in the morning feeling entering withdrawal, they're in a state of, I can now go to work. I can now, you know, make breakfast for my kids. I can now, you know, engage with my family again. And these drugs work. They're effective when they're properly treated in proper circumstances 80 to 85% of the time, whereas recovery fails 90 to 95% of the time within a year. And we have a 100-year history of data on that, so I'm not even going to argue that.
You're talking about Suboxone?
I'm talking about, no, the big M that no one in the room has been talked about, which is the better drug than Suboxone.
But we hear often about Suboxone. Why is that?
Because people can make lots of money on it.
That's right.
It's another pharmaceutical drug that costs massive amounts of money. Mm-hmm. And even more money can be made trying to sell opioid antagonist drug that blocks the effects of opioids, Vivitrol, an injectable, an implantable opioid antagonist, for which there is almost no evidence that it works. Mm-hmm.
Kelvin, I wanted to get your perspective. Robert Heimer says that abstinence doesn't work, that people do need medicated assistant treatment.
I don't want to be that simplistic. It works for some people, but it's a small percent. Mm-hmm. And I, as an epidemiologist, I think in numbers. I, you know, the joke about an epidemiologist is, I can't help you unless there are 10 or more of you.
Mm-hmm. Kelvin, what is your reaction to what Robert's saying?
I know abstinence works for me, and I know it works for a lot of people. And to be honest, to be very authentic in my words and speaking up here, I have a lot of reservations about medication assistant treatment. I really do. You know, and at the same time, I look at how the pharmaceutical companies, how they pretty much, you know, they got a part to play in this epidemic. And now we're looking at the big pharma to come up with a solution, so to speak, with their medication-assisted treatment. So therefore, they're making money from both sides of the ends here and laughing all the way to the bank while our loved ones are dying. Our family members are dying. Suboxone's still a narcotic, you know. And but at the same time, being in the trenches, being working with people that have these different experiences, I understand that there's many pathways to recovery, and abstinence works for me. And but therefore, as a recovery coach, as a connecting with the individuals that's suffering from addiction, it's important for them to make an informed decision about the choices they make in their lives. And if they choose to use any type of medication-assisted treatment, have a plan to wean off. I have friends that's on MATs that are afraid to get off. And it's important while you want to call it stabilized with these medication-assisted treatment, it's important to do the inner work we ought to do to find that freedom from that addiction. And another thing I want to touch upon is, as a community, we need to reframe or maybe change the perception of how we look at people experiencing addiction and the labels and the language that we use of people that have these addictive experiences, saying the word addict or alcoholic. You know, I tend to say the addicted person or the person that experiencing an addiction. You know, because behind the so-called addict, behind the so-called addicted behavior is a human being that experienced so much type of different emotional, even physical pain and distress. Stigma is something that is a big barrier that for people to not want to receive support in the first place. So if we change the language that we describe people that have these experiences and educate people on addiction all throughout the community, I think is so important.
You're talking about stigma. I mentioned Sue has traveled the state, has talked with families, communities, you've talked at schools. How do people perceive someone who has a substance abuse problem? And is there blame that is pointed towards the family?
So it depends. In my little world, people know I'm a safe place to come and share their secrets or their child's secrets. And people aren't afraid to talk about it with me. And they're certainly not going to make me feel bad about losing a child to addiction. But then when I step back, and I kind of leave my own little bubble and I read comments on a newspaper article, and there's a lot of it, thinning the herd, or, you know, it was their choice, that kind of thing. And that's ugly.
Because there is this belief by some that, well, why can't the person just stop abusing the drug?
I thought the same thing.
Robert Heimer, tell us what's happening to the brain when someone becomes addicted to something like heroin.
Heroin acts as a driver of the pleasure reward system of the brain. It's the same part of the brain that's stimulated by food or sex. But what happens with drugs of addiction is that they create a system in which that part of the brain is overly reinforced, not only when the drugs are administered, but even in the contemplation of taking the drugs. Mm. So you can see release of the transmitter in this part of the brain that says, I'm being rewarded, I am entering a euphoric state, even before the drug enters somebody's vein. And because of that pressure and because of that memory that's seated in the brain, that does not go away. And this is a memory that people reinforce 3 and 4 times a day when they inject drugs, when they take their pharmaceutical opioids because they have developed opioid use disorder. That's why recovery is really hard. That's why people relapse all the time. That's why medications are important, and that's even why I don't see the need. If you're on a long-acting drug like methadone or buprenorphine that's working, I see no need to wean. You would never say, okay, someone's got diabetes, we treat them with insulin, we're going to wean them off insulin. The pancreas doesn't go back to normal. I'm going to wean somebody off their antihypertensive drugs. Their blood pressure will shoot right back up. And that's also true with opioids, at least for many years. And if people are going to wean themselves off of their medications, then they better do it with doctor supervision, because if they relapse, they're going to go out and use a street drug of unknown potency, and they're going to put them at great risk of opioid overdose. And they're going to do it, and they're going to feel guilty about it, and no one's going to know about it, and no one's going to be around with naloxone to reverse their overdose. So this has to be done with care and with the help of properly trained doctors.
I wanted to shift a little and to talk about some of the options for families who are trying to connect their loved one to some type of treatment program. We hear so often when we talk about addiction on where we live that there aren't enough beds to help people who are ready for rehabilitation. Mm-hmm. So when your son reached out to you for help and you had to send him to Florida and you had to pay for that yourself, not all families have those resources.
What you want to do for your child, mm-hmm. right? But I mean, that's ridiculous to have to put your kid blindly on a plane or parent, you know, whoever, to go out of state to some facility you have never seen, know nothing about, and off they go. I hope that's changed, but yeah, that's ridiculous. But this is Kelvin.
Kelvin, what options do families have? What does insurance pay for? And then to follow up with Robert, what is proven to help people in their path to recovery in terms of how many days they need in a residential treatment facility if they can get a bed?
Yeah, and that's one of the big issues that we're dealing with, and especially with the Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services dealing with a lot of cuts, you know, a bed's not really, really available, and it's a big challenge for a lot of family members. And but one thing I can say about, you know, Aware Recovery Care, you know, we're an in-home addiction treatment program. So we're a one-year program. People come out of detox or even come out of a 30-day program. You know, people do very well once they get access or get a bed in a drug treatment program. But when they go back to the communities, that's where they deal with a lot of the stressors, a lot of the pressure, and a lot of the issues that they may be dealing with. And we have a whole team of people that's there to support them on their healing journey of recovery, from a psychiatrist to a therapist to a licensed marriage and family counselor. Whereas, you know, this is a family affair. You know what I mean? We need to deal with the family dynamics as well, too. And most importantly, is the recovery coaches, the people with lived experience that are really able to listen to the direction they want to go with their recovery and support them on their healing journey. And how cost-effective it is, whereas the program at Aware Recovery Care, for the whole year program, is the same amount as a one-month inpatient treatment program. And a lot of insurance companies are looking at that and saying, that's something to really consider. And our success rate is 6 times higher than the natural average, because I believe it's really important to they get that support in the community. In CCAR, they have also recovery coaches that's in emergency departments, you know, and really catching them while they have that window of opportunity to give them the support they need if they choose to, whether they want to go to some type of program or whatever the case may be.
Robert, through your work, especially with the Connecticut Opioid Response Team, what are effective ways to help people if they can't get into that 30-day program? Are some of the programs Kelvin talking about good fits?
I'm going to say two things right now that are very controversial. We do not need more beds. We need more meds. And I'm going to go further in saying that detox is unethical medical treatment. If you put people through detox and you send them back out without proper care, what happens is they have reduced tolerance to drugs. They tend, in that case, to have higher rates of overdose. When people come out of 30-day treatment programs, especially if they leave ahead of the end of those 30 days, they have higher rates of opioid overdose. We don't need that kind of treatment. It doesn't work for most people, for enough people that it's continuing to contribute to our opioid overdose death epidemic. We need to get people onto medications that have been proven effective and whose stigmatization continues to hamper their proper implementation. The state of Connecticut has restricted the expansion of methadone programs in Waterbury, Torrington, and New Haven by putting a moratorium on new Medicaid slots for these drugs. That is an incredible, unethical thing to do. It's put people at risk. It's prevented people from going to programs in their communities where they don't have to travel great distances to get the care they need, with services that include the kind of mental health and other wraparound services that that inpatient recovery programs can't give. They can provide people with treatment for the medical problems like their hepatitis C that they've gotten from injecting drug use, with social services. Those kind of programs have the greatest rate of being effective. And the programs in Bridgeport and New Haven that I know, you can get into treatment in 90 minutes. You don't have to wait days for a bed. You can get treatment today. Go in, get an intake. We'll get you on a dose of medication in 90 minutes that will relieve your craving and get you off of the illegal drugs. And remember, the definition of addiction is not dependence on opioids. It's continued use of opioids despite the negative consequences. If those drugs are being prescribed under medical supervision, you've gotten rid of the negative consequences and you've provided positive consequences. So under those circumstances, when people are being treated with buprenorphine and methadone, they are not addicted. They're being maintained. They are being properly treated for a disease that has perhaps irreparably changed their brain. And where having opiates on board is the normal situation.
So can that get started after an overdose when somebody's in the hospital instead of just released?
Absolutely. The emergency department at Yale has pioneered a program that's now expanding to other Yale-affiliated hospitals in the state, where if you come in with an overdose or even a diagnosis of opioid use disorder, they will try to get you a dose of buprenorphine right there and connect you with a community provider who can prescribe buprenorphine so that you never have to go into withdrawal. And that is the safest and most effective way to deal with opioid use disorder. And yes, it means you're going to be on a drug the rest of your life. I have a family history of heart disease. I am on statins for the rest of my life. Thank goodness for medications.
But we don't have to be, I don't know. As a human being, we're more than just our physical body. There's a mental, there's an emotional, there's a spiritual aspects to us as well, too. And, by saying that I need to be on a drug for the rest of my life, which I've been in recovery for 8 years, abstinence, and I know I'm on a healing journey. It's a healing journey that I'm doing. And, it seems to me that a drug dealer now is not on the streets no more. They have white coats. They have fancy offices. And the cartels, and it's not in Mexico. It's not in Colombia. It's not in Afghanistan. They're right here in Connecticut called Purdue Pharma. They're influencing so many people, so many different communities, saying that we need their drugs for the rest of their life. We can heal. Our bodies have a natural ability to heal itself under the right conditions, But, when we have doctors telling us that we're going to need a drug for the rest of our life, statin is maybe a lifestyle change will get you off of those particular drugs. Maybe eating certain foods, which foods have a direct direct connections to different diseases. So a lot of these chronic diseases can really be changed by a lifestyle. And just really learning how to look at it as healing, not necessarily as I need a drug for the rest of my life. That's Wow, that's putting myself in a box if I believe that.
Kelvin is right. Kelvin is right that for some people can change their lives. The vast majority do not. The percentage of people who can control their cholesterol through diet and exercise is tiny. The same is true for addiction. The percentage of people who can control their use purely by force of will through abstinence is tiny. And let's not forget that. The people who promote recovery are in the majority of people. People who are still using drugs every day because recovery and abstinence doesn't work for them are not up here on this stage.
There's 23 million people in long-term recovery today. And I'm so proud to be one of them. I know Mario is one of them. I know Carol is one of them. I know Anna is one of them. There's other people in here as well, too. Faith is one of them. So I'm just proud to be in recovery.
That's Kelvin Young, a certified recovery advisor at Aware Recovery Care Incorporated, speaking to Dr. Robert Heimer, professor of epidemiology and pharmacology at Yale School of Public Health. Both men were on a panel WNPR hosted, along with Sue Kruzek, a Guilford, Connecticut mother who lost her son Nick to an opioid overdose. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Coming up, we hear from audience members who attended the discussion. Many of them have been directly affected by substance abuse. We'll hear what steps they'd like to see local communities take to stem the opioid epidemic. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Today we're listening back to a panel discussion we hosted about how local communities should address the opioid crisis in Connecticut. The discussion was held at Gateway Community College in New Haven. Our guests on the panel were Dr. Robert Heimer, professor of epidemiology and pharmacology at Yale School of Public Health, also a member of the Connecticut Opioid Response Team. Kelvin Young, a certified recovery advisor at Aware Recovery Care Incorporated. And Sue Kruzek, a Guilford, Connecticut resident and mother of a son who died from an opioid overdose. I asked audience members to respond to what the panelists had shared and to talk about their personal experiences with substance abuse.
Hi, everybody. My name is Carol Cruz. I'm a person in long-term recovery since 1994, and I have a lot of my colleagues here that we're in the trenches every day. I work in the field as a recovery coach in a local detox center and outpatient program, serving clients with methadone, medication assistance treatment, Suboxone. I came through the ranks of 12-step program. Abstinence was the only pathway that I knew of. I've had to shift my thinking and be more open and broaden my mind that, yes, recovery has a pathway of health. Recovery has a pathway of medication assistance treatment. I feel that, you know, we really need to look at the whole person holistically. And that includes the family, that includes treating the family, treating the individual, having these wraparound services. Most of the clients that I work with, the first thing I ask them is, when's the last time you had a physical? Something as simple as that we take advantage of. We just don't think about. So, this is very passionate to all of us. And we're not going to get it done in one day. But we really need to start working with each other and stop blaming Big Pharma and everybody else and just start coming together. We all have great ideas. We're strong people. I didn't think that what I would be doing today 23 years ago. I really didn't. I thought I was dead, you know. But the bottom line is that we have a lot of information, but we need to sit down and just not just watch films, not just check off the box, but really get our hands dirty.
Who else?
Hey, I'm Mario Dierno. I'm a person, and I'm in recovery as well. There's like a few things I just think that burn me up all the time. It's the same problems. There's no one right way, you know? I'm different than my friend Brandon right here. There's no one right way. We're all different. So my recovery looks different than someone else's. My treatment plan should look different. Do I believe in medicated assistance treatment? For certain people, yes. My question to people that, you know, have you ever been on Suboxone or methadone? I have. That's a nasty mother effer. Try to get off that. Try to see and just try it. And it doesn't stop anyway, because I've been on Suboxone and been able to use crack cocaine, alcohol. You can do everything else. It's not the answer. For me, I'm saying. I don't know about everyone else, but for me. And the recovery is the most important thing in my life. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mario.
Just a couple more questions.
Hello, my name is Jamano Kimber. I have a comment question. Dr. Hyman, I don't know if you remember, we worked together back in the 90s to bring harm reduction here to the state, and it's great to hear that, you know, the work that we did back then, you know, has manifested, because it took you 9 months to get a methadone program, so to hear you can come in one day and get dosed is a great accomplishment in the system. And I think I have to push back, Calvin. I just have to congratulate you the way that you represented the recovery community. You know, one of the questions I got to you, Bob, is why aren't any consumers on that governance panel? I think that the people that are closest to the problem are closest to the solution. Mm. And with the tremendous amount of respect that I have for you and the work that you've done over the years, I mean, it's taken us this long to get this far, right? There's still a lot of work out there to be done. You know, the resources aren't there, and it's not so much as, you know, the beds and the facilities, but it's, you know, equipping the ground soldiers. You know, I heard somebody say the people that are right there in the trenches and mm-hmm. making treatment accessible. You know, ATR came about because of advocacy, CCAR, and a lot of programs. The access to treatment came about through, you know, the men and women that testified at the General Assembly, you know, at the legislator, you know, the encouragement about this is, you know, a disease, you know, and stop incarcerating people, and it fell on deaf ears for years. I guess the last thing that I want to leave out there is that I agree wholeheartedly with Calvin, because I'm somebody that survived jails, institutions, and death, right, and then was abstinent. And then I got in a car accident and wound up on mild pain meds, Vicodin, and then lost everything, you know, turned into full-blown addiction after being clean for 15 years. Lost two houses, two cars, you know, had a clean record, I got education, you know, it just turned my life upside down. And so I had an option this time, you know, to go on to methadone maintenance, but I chose an abstinent model because I do believe that the body and the brain has the ability to heal itself. It's how we put together treatment. You know, the medication can stop you from using for a time, but you need the skills, you know, to deal with the cravings and the triggers and begin to cope with life and a lot of the emotional pain that was never addressed in the beginning. So I wanted to throw that out there.
We'll take one more question.
Thank you. I'm a mom. My son overdosed on February 14th of 2016. He would have been the 918th death of that year had he not survived. He was 6 days in a coma, 12 days in the hospital, and we're very thankful that he's in recovery. And one thing I'm really glad to hear in the room is people talking about family, so thank you for bringing that up. And I also want to say that, just to back up what he just said, that when you talk so frankly about this stuff, you're robbing people of their hope in some ways, too, because I don't get a choice on what my son decides to do with his recovery. That's his choice at this point. So just keep that in mind as you talk so frankly about these things. It's really better to have an open dialogue for some of us, because we really are just holding on to whatever we can. I wanted to tell you just briefly that right after my son overdosed, he went into a family program, and I've been since trying to advocate for family programming here in New Haven, because I think that's a big part of what they come home to. Along with that, I want to talk about the fact that after that I was diagnosed with cancer, I was in Nebraska and out of town, and somebody offered me pain medications over and over again. And in my head, I'm thinking, I don't know that my son could say no as many times as I had to in that situation, and I called her out on it. There's no open software, as I understand it, that helps doctors to see the background of the patient that's in front of them. And even just this week, dealing with my own health situation, I'm dealing with doctors who are in and out of different softwares that, even here in town, I was out of town when I was diagnosed, I could understand that they didn't have my background then. But right here in town, I have people that have no idea what my background is, have no idea if I'm in recovery or not, have no idea if I'm on methadone or not. When are we going to open up the doors of communication for medicine so that we can be helped and served and not undermined in our own good recovery? Thank you.
Does anyone want to respond to her comments, Robert?
Yeah, we do have a huge problem in this country because we don't have a comprehensive system of electronic medical record reporting. There are far more deaths in this country every year from misprescribed medications that are not opioids that occur because of that. Many Americans have this thing about privacy and therefore oppose the idea of having, you know, electronic medical records that doctors can see. And so the growth of those things has been very, very slow. The state does have a prescription monitoring system that doctors are supposed to log into for scheduled medications, and that includes opioids, benzodiazepines, sedatives of other kinds, and doctors are supposed to check those things to see what's being prescribed to prevent duplicate prescribing and to look for interactions and to try to control high dose opioid prescribing in combination with benzodiazepines that contributes to the overdose death problem. So we're working on, that's one of the things of the Connecticut Opioid Response Plan, is to make sure that doctors know about this and use the system and are properly trained to use it so that they treat their patients, at least when it comes to the prescribing of opioids, in a more rational and evidence-based way. So I'm hoping that that takes off. This program has only been in the state for 7 years now. Its use is growing, but the problem is, as you point out, it's only Connecticut. So we could not go and see that you might have been prescribed that somewhere out of state. But we are a country of 50 states, and how we're going to get beyond that is very complicated.
Kelvin and Sue, I wanted to ask you before we wrap some thoughts on where we should go from here. We shouldn't end this conversation tonight. What do you want people to do when they go back into their communities?
I think just understanding the CSI model, which stands for community systems and individuals, to really bring that all together. So community aspects of it is we all need to come back together and really support one another and really educate and take away the misconceptions that people have with addictions. So coming together, having these community conversations, having discussions and on working on healthy solutions to support people that's experiencing addictions. And we got to look at the systems that's in place here. One of the things I learned in recovery is, you know, the definition of insanity is doing a thing over and over again, expecting different results. You know, some of the things in these systems are not working. So we need to scrap a lot of this stuff and come back to the table and change some of these policies. And it's so important to have people at the table. Nothing about us without us in the recovery community. So therefore, we need people that have lived experience to be at the table and talk about how they navigate their experiences and just really talking about how to navigate the system and to create policies in place that really help us to sustain recovery and individuals, and really empowering people to take personal responsibility for their health and well-being, and having that community support to really support people that experience an addiction in the community. There's organizations like CCAR, organizations like Facing Addiction that you can reach out to, and they have a vast amount of information and resources that you can either look at and really connect yourself to.
Sue,
I think if somebody's in the emergency room, treatment needs to be in place and started before they're released, whether it's going to detox. That's all I know. And making sure that they're not hitting the streets, running to their first, the closest drug dealer, because that is what a lot of them do after they've been brought back. I keep saying, if I was talked off a ledge and I got up, they wouldn't say goodbye, Sue, have a good day. And that's what I see happening in the ERs with our addicts that are being brought back. So I'd like to see that one changed. And we're all in this together. They say it takes a village. We're everybody's village. And, thank you for everybody that came out and just keep talking about it. I think we're all here because we're talking about it.
Thanks to Dr. Robert Heimer, professor of epidemiology and pharmacology at Yale School of Public Health, a member of the Connecticut Opioid Response Team, Kelvin Young, a certified recovery advisor at Aware Recovery Care Incorporated, and Sue Kruzek, a Guilford, Connecticut resident. Where We Live is produced by Lydia Brown and Carmen Baskoff. Our technical producer is Kion Wolf. WMPR's executive producer is Katie Tolarski. Special thanks to Beth Messina, Nancy Bauer, Jane Marino, Carol Pompano, Gateway's EdTech team, and Blue Plate Kitchen. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. As always, thanks for listening.